Hello, and thank you for joining us for this webinar on insurance in construction. My name is Peter Stockhill. I'm a partner at Penington's Manches Cooper. I'll be discussing notification issues in relation to claims for fire safety. I'm pleased to be joined by Paul Lowe, a partner at Waitmans.
Thank you, Peter. I will be discussing the Building Safety Bill and its relevance, particularly for the insurance markets, but for all those who are responsible for fire safety issues within buildings. Thank you for joining us. Peter, over to you for the first part of our webinar.
Thank you. So for the next 25 minutes, I'm going to talk about notifications under professional indemnity insurance policies relating to fire safety and external wall construction. The image on this slide has become a common scene over the last 3.5 years since the tragic events at Grenfell Tower in June 2017. But property owners and those responsible for the repair of properties have had to investigate and, where appropriate, take steps to redress issues in relation to fire safety and external wall construction. The ripple effect of that, of course, has been to spawn claims against those responsible for the original development of a building or its refurbishment, and from there on to the contractors and professionals who participated in that development. Behind those contractors and professionals, of course, sit their professional indemnity insurers. These claims have tended to be met by the professional indemnity insurance rather than, for example, public liability insurers, because, of course, in the vast majority of cases, there's no actual damage to property. I'm going to look in particular at the issue of scope of notification. I'm also going to touch briefly on aggregation, which may well also have a bearing on these matters. So, scope of notification. Why is it that concerns over fire safety have created issues in relation to scope of notification? Well, it's in particular because of the way in which the issues have evolved over recent years, and that became particularly pronounced, I would suggest, throughout 2020. Some of the reasons for that were that there were a lot of schemes to carry out remedial works getting up and running. And during the course of the investigations for those schemes, or in the course of undertaking those schemes, additional defects were discovered once cladding panels were taken off across a building, and the opportunity arose for more to be seen either within the same system or in adjacent systems on the building. Similarly, inspections have become more and more common for the purpose of obtaining what's called an EWS1 form, the form devised by the RICS to give insurers comfort that the external wall construction of buildings in respect of which they are lending don't give rise to fire safety issues. And in addition to that, and this was a particular issue in the latter part of 2020, lots of investigations on buildings were being undertaken in support of applications to the government's Building Safety Fund for non-ACM cladding schemes. There'd been an earlier scheme in relation to ACM cladding, and the scheme in relation to non-ACM cladding systems had a deadline of the end of last year for full applications, which prompted a lot of investigations and, as a result, a lot of new claims or the enlargement of existing claims. That deadline has, in fact, now been extended, so that situation is likely to continue. Why does that have a particular effect on professional indemnity insurance policies? Well, professional indemnity insurance policies are invariably written on a claims-made basis. That means that it's the policy in effect when the claim is first made that will respond to it. Those policies will contain an obligation on the insured to notify claims and also circumstances, usually defined as being circumstances which may give rise to a claim. The policy will then contain a deeming provision, the effect of which is that if a claim is made after the expiry of the policy period, which relates back to a circumstance that was notified within the policy period, then that claim will be deemed to have been first made during the policy period. So what then happens if the claim that is ultimately made is broader than the notification that was made? Well, if you think about it, that could arise in a couple of situations. It could arise in circumstances where the original notification and the enlargement, as it were, both happen within the same policy period, or it could be the case that the enlargement happens in a subsequent policy period. Where those two things happen in the same policy period, the effect will depend upon whether the enlarged claim is treated as all relating back to and forming part of that first claim or not. And that will impact on the number of excesses payable. And under some policies, the excesses are quite large. And it will also impact, assuming the limit of indemnity is written on an each and every claim basis, on the limits or limits of indemnity available for the claim. And many of these cladding replacement schemes, particularly on tall buildings, do run into several millions of pounds. The problems become even more pronounced if the initial notification and the enlargement straddle policy periods. That might result in different insurers being on risk, and they may have different views as to the extent to which the earlier policy responds to the enlarged claim. The later policy might be on different and possibly less generous terms. The professional indemnity insurance market has reacted to the wake of Grenfell by being more careful in the terms on which it's written cover for claims in relation to fire safety and external wall construction. And so for those notifications that were made to policies incepted before June 2017, there may well be more generous cover than is available to a policy written after that time. From a claimant's perspective, if the insured is no longer trading and hasn't bought runoff cover, it may also be the case that to the extent the claim doesn't attach back to a policy that was notified before the insured became insolvent, that actually there's no cover at all for that part of the claim. So how does the law determine the number of claims for policy purposes? Well, it's necessary to look at two different circumstances: the circumstance in which a claim has been notified and the circumstance in which what the policy calls a circumstance has been notified. Before looking at either of those, it's necessary to observe that this issue will potentially be heavily influenced by the policy terms and indeed by the nature of the situation that's arisen. Subject to that important caveat, how does the law determine the scope of a claim? Well, here are a number of points that can be taken from the cases. First, claim doesn't mean the same thing as cause of action, and multiple causes of action may amount to the same claim. We know that instinctively, don't we? How often do letters of claim and particulars of claim involve multiple causes of action? Rather, the cases say we look to the object being claimed to determine the scope of the claim. Now, that object may be multifaceted. It's quite common, of course, in building defect claims for there to be multiple defects. That doesn't mean there are multiple claims. So it's perfectly possible for there to be a multifaceted object, so to speak. What effect does what the claimant have to say about these matters have on the policy response? Well, the cases tell us that the relevant communications from the claimant are relevant and indeed may be a good starting point, but they are not determinative. Claimants can't manipulate the policy response, for example, by separating out a claim into multiple smaller claims when in truth it all forms part of one claim. Now, what if, as in the circumstances I've been describing, matters are notified over time? Well, the cases say it depends on the facts of each case whether later complaints are an enlargement of an existing claim or are separate claims. And where a claim is generally described, for example, in a protective claim form, what is or may be covered by a generally described claim simply depends upon what are in context the matters which can properly be described as covered by the particular claim. Well, that guidance is quite general in nature. I'll come on in a moment to touch on how the question of enlargement is dealt with in the context of circumstances. But it's appropriate to observe that there is a need for guidance here from the courts on whether and in what ways this issue is dealt with differently in the context of claims rather than circumstances. Turning to deal then with how the law determines the scope of a notification of a circumstance, to answer that, we need to go back to a couple of cases that bookended 2007. The first of those is the first instance decision in a case called HLB Kidsons and certain Lloyd's underwriters. Now, this case did go on to the Court of Appeal, but for our purposes, we want to look at the first instance judgment of Mrs. Justice Gloucester, as she then was. Remember that name, we'll come back to her. She held that, again, subject to the policy terms, the general legal test as to the correct interpretation of a notification is an objective test, but it does take account of the insured's actual knowledge. And she acknowledged in the quotes I've given you here from paragraph 76 that there may well be uncertainty at the time of the notification as to the precise problems that have become apparent. That is not a reason why a notification can't be given. On the next slide, I've given you a quote from paragraph 78 of the judgment. This refers to the deeming provision that I mentioned earlier. Here, the deeming provision said that any loss or claim to which the notified circumstance has given rise will relate back to the notification of that circumstance. And when applying that sort of wording, and wording like that is very common, the loss or claim has to be sufficiently causally related to the fact, event, happening or condition which comprises the notified circumstance that it can fairly be said to have arisen out of it. On the next slide, I mentioned the case of Kojima and the Underwriter Insurance Company. This case was heard at the end of 2007 in the Technology and Construction Court. The judge in this case had the benefit of the first instance decision in Kidsons, and applying that made a number of observations in paragraph 99, which provide a very useful checklist for considering these sorts of issues. I highlight two of them in particular for present purposes. First, that the insured must be aware of the circumstances it is notifying. That certainly does not require a complete understanding, but the insured cannot simply say there may be some unknown or unidentified defects. Second, any claim which arose consequently from the notified circumstances would arise from those circumstances. There must be some causal as opposed to coincidental link between the notified circumstances and the later claim. Now, Kojima concerned a residential building that had been constructed from a series of prefabricated pods and flat pack elements. A notification was made to insurers by Kojima in February 2001 to the effect that there was that the pods were settling and moving excessively, causing adjoining roofing and balconies and walkways to distort under differential settlement. There was reference to related damage and risk, and to the fact that an investigation was underway to identify stroke confirm cause and potential effect stroke risk. So this was a notification that was specific in the sense that it related to distortion observed on balconies and walkways and to differential settlement. And so the judge, faced with a whole series of different defects discovered somewhat later, concluded that there must be a causal connection shown between those defects and what was covered by that notification. Now, the Kojima judgment doesn't go through all of those defects. It was more of a decision on the principles, but you can see the application of the Kidsons approach in the context of construction defects there. Moving on to the next slide, 10 years, coincidentally, to the day after the hearings in Kojima closed, the Commercial Court began hearing a case called Europools and RSA. This was a case about the installation of a swimming pool. The swimming pool involved a series of movable booms that were designed to rise and fall to enable the operator of the swimming pool to divide it into different areas for different activities. Simply put, the booms had within them tanks which could be filled with air to enable them to rise in the water. The booms weren't rising and falling properly, and a notification was made. At that time, Europools believed that it could correct the issue by installing some inflatable bags, but it did acknowledge that it wasn't entirely sure of the cause. The solution didn't work, and sometime later, Europol's instead replaced the air drive system with a hydraulic system, so obviating any problem with the tanks. At first instance in the commercial court, the judge found that because Europol's was not at the time of the original notification aware of or did not believe there was a problem with the air drive system, but rather a problem with the tanks, that it couldn't have notified that underlying problem at the time. Europol's appealed, where they went to a court of appeal led by Dame Elizabeth Gloucester, who had heard the Kidson's case. The appeal was successful. A court of appeal held that there was sufficient causal connection between the defects in the air drive system, the change to a hydraulic system, and the defects in the tank that were notified. And so the Court of Appeal confirmed that where a symptom of an underlying cause is notified, that notification will be an effective notification of the symptom and of the cause or causes of that symptom, and indeed of the other symptoms of the underlying cause or causes. And it doesn't matter, certainly in the context of a notification where the insured recognises that they don't know the underlying cause, that the insured did not know of that cause at the time. It's sufficient that the insured knew of the symptoms of that cause. On the next slide, I mention, and we need only touch on this briefly, the case of the Cultural Foundation and Beazley. This was an architect's professional negligence case. And this underscores a point I made earlier about the importance of the policy terms. Here, the definition of the circumstance was not the more common may give rise to a claim, but was a likely threshold, suggests that a claim is likely. The cases tell us that may means not fanciful, real, significantly less than 50%, for example, whereas, of course, likely will hover more around that 50% and upwards threshold. And the court remarked here that a likely threshold makes it more difficult to make a hornet's nest type notification. Well, what do we mean by that? Hornet's nest is a term that the courts and commentators have tended to use to apply to situations where the notification is of an awareness that an individual has habitually been making mistakes, or that a practice a firm was engaged in was erroneous. And at the time, the full implications of that practice are not understood. Query whether it's helpful to apply that title to building defects simply because the situation is not fully understood. But in any case, what the court was saying here was that if an insured has to get over a likely threshold, that a hornet's nest or an unknown situation is going to be more difficult in terms of the insured's ability to make a notification of it. But I do stress there is a distinction to be drawn between awareness of matters and awareness of the underlying cause of those matters. So moving on to the next slide and applying what we've just discussed to fire safety issues. Well, a notification that is specific, for example, to the use of a particular type of cladding panel or the use of a particular cladding panel with a certain installation may have had limited potential to have a sufficient causal connection to other defects that is discovered subsequently. So for example, if the notification is of the sort I've just described, but it's subsequently discovered that there's also a design defect in relation to the cavity barriers that are supposed to prevent smoke and fire spreading behind the cladding panels, then the notification may not be broad enough to cover those. If the notification relates to the cladding system more generally, particularly if that is prompted by some communication from the claimant, then that may well have greater potential. But again, we've got to go back to the insured's awareness and that causal connection test. And even where we have a notification that's broad in the sense that it covers many aspects of a single cladding system, lots of buildings have multiple cladding or facade systems on them, and a notification specific to one is unlikely to apply to others. Equally, An insured can't manipulate the situation to attempt to give a notification in relation to facade systems generally, if in fact the only issues that are being contemplated relate to one cladding system. Or put another way, if an insured seeks to look back to a notification that was made at the time when the only issue considered related to one cladding system, then that can't retrospectively be broadened to cover things that nobody was considering at the time. C conversely, the obverse situation may also apply. I've been considering when a circumstance might not be as broad as the ultimate claim, but it's conceivable that a circumstance could be broader than any particular claim. And that might arise, for example, where a number of buildings are covered by the same notification. How does the law decide whether all those complaints in relation to all those buildings could amount to more than one claim or a single claim? Well, here's a few scenarios to consider. If there are different parties and different contracts, then that's likely to point towards there being separate claims for policy purposes. Where there's one contract for different buildings relating to the same default, when I would have thought that's rather closer to being a single claim, assuming that claim's made at a single point in time. What though if there's one contract for different buildings and different defaults? Well, then we're moving down the spectrum further towards separate claims, aren't we? These matters are all very fact sensitive. But I think those are reasonable starting points for considering those sorts of situations. Finally, on this topic, it's necessary just to mention the notion of waiver by estoppel. If an insurer wants to take a point that the enlargement of an ongoing situation doesn't relate back to an earlier notification, then they need to do that promptly, either specifically or at least initially under a general reservation of rights. If the insurer continues to deal with the matter as a single claim, it may well be precluded from taking a point later that, in fact, there's more than one claim. Turning then to the question of aggregation. Now, what I've just been describing is whether, as a matter of law, there is one claim or more than one claim. Sometimes that's referred to as aggregation at law. What I'm turning to now is aggregation in a narrower sense, aggregation under the policy terms. Now, a policy, of course, might have an overall aggregate limit of indemnity, so not a limit of indemnity for each and every claim, but a limit of indemnity for all claims. Alternatively, there might be aggregate limits for certain types of risk, and it's quite common now to see aggregate limits of indemnity for claims in relation to fire safety or cladding, either from the ground up, as it were, or from a certain financial threshold. In addition, or alternatively, a policy may also contain an aggregation clause treating individual claims as a single claim, either for the purpose of the excess or the limit of indemnity or both. Those types of clauses tend to operate by identifying a common unifying factor to bring those separate claims together for policy purposes. That unifying factor might be an event, occurrence, or incident. It might be act, error, or omission, matters or transactions, proximate cause or underlying cause. And indeed, it might be some combination of those terms, like event or series of events, or similar acts or omissions in related matters. There's a significant body of case law, some very authoritative on these types of wordings, and that's really beyond the scope of this talk. One observation I would make is that in the context of the type of cases that we are discussing, an event, occurrence, or incident wording can be slightly awkward to apply. In circumstances where there's been no fire, no damage to other property, there's nothing that might naturally be described as an event. And so what ends up having to consider whether concepts like the issue of a negligent design or the implementation of that design is the event for policy purposes, or whether that event wording is simply inapplicable altogether. I hope that's been useful. Just a few practical points on which I will close. For those of you advising parties responsible for the repair of buildings who are pursuing claims, if your client has appointed the contractors or professionals against whom a claim may be made, then they probably have a little bit of information about their insurance arrangements, a policy certificate, for example, that was supplied on appointment. Well worth taking account of when the policy period is likely to end, the current policy period, and trying to ensure that fulsome information is provided within the same policy period to try and avoid some of the issues that I've described. That initial notification letter is very likely to be passed on to the insurers. So that is your opportunity to try and put before them all the matters that you would want to be notified. For those making notifications, again, it is your opportunity to provide fulsome information to the insurers. And it may well be appropriate to acknowledge in that notification that you don't have a full understanding of all of the implications of the situation at that time. For those advising insurers and insurers themselves, I'd say the key takeaway from this is the need to be alive to the potential for these types of claim to grow and of the need to take quick action if you're going to consider whether the enlargement of a claim means that it has become more than one claim for policy purposes. I hope that's been helpful. I'm very pleased now to be able to hand over to Paul Lowe, who's going to talk to you about the Building Safety Bill.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for the introduction. I'll be speaking to you about the Building Safety Bill. The Building Safety Bill is the UK government's landmark piece of legislation aimed at improving building safety, largely in response to the Grenfell Tower disaster and the problems which have been widespread through the industry as a consequence of that disaster. The bill has been described as the most significant piece of legislation affecting the construction industry and associated professions within the last 40 years. And I think that's no exaggeration. I will take you through the bill now. And if I just turn to the next slide, the program I have in mind for us is to have a short recap as to why the bill is necessary and the background to the bill. I'll then explain in a little bit more detail what the building safety system brought in by the current legislation actually involves and what will be required as a consequence. I'll then turn to what these changes mean for insurers. Should we have time, I'll also consider one or two case studies before finally turning to the vexed issue of cladding remediation and ongoing discussions about how cladding remediation can be funded. That's the program I have in mind for us. If I turn to the next slide, I'll just very briefly at the outset discuss what the Building Safety Bill is in outline. The bill was published in July of 2020 in draft and is currently making its way through Parliament, likely to, we are told, receive royal assent at some point in 2021, although there's been no date set for that yet. And there's also likely various amendments to the bill as it passes through Parliament. The bill is unquestionably an incredibly complex piece of legislation. It's in five parts and 119 sections and eight schedules. You'll be pleased to hear that I'm not proposing to take you through each of those individual sections, but I will be focusing on the principal parts which I think will be of most relevance to this audience. And those parts are part two, which deal with how a new building safety regulator will be established on a statutory basis. Part three, which sets out the details of the new regulatory regime, which will apply during the design and construction phase of higher risk buildings. And part four, which will deal with how high risk buildings are managed during the occupancy phase, and in particular, the new role of an accountable person. If any of you are interested in finding out even more about the bill, it'd be worth your while having a look at the detailed explanatory notes, which are come with the bill and can be found on the government's website. There's also likely to be a vast amount of secondary legislation required to bring in various parts of the regulations, which are only referred to at present in the Building Safety Bill. I ought to make clear that at this point, as I'm speaking, the scope of the Building Safety Bill, we are told, is to be buildings of 18 metres higher in residential occupation. But we're also being told that it's likely that that scope will be increased, and we will see other types of sensitive buildings falling within the scope of the proposed legislation. In my mind, that's a sensible step. And if the requirements of building safety are applicable to high-rise residential, surely ought to be also applied in equal measure to other types of sensitive buildings where there is concerns about the impact of building safety. So I'll come on to that in a little bit. But just firstly, turning to where we are and how we've got to the building safety bill as it currently stands, and that's my next slide. I think it's perhaps worthwhile just casting our mind back to what the problems are here and how the construction industry and those associated with it have been affected by problems with building safety in recent years. When I was sort of considering this, there are a number of cases which came to mind immediately for me. The first one was a fire in a tower block in Madrid in 2005, a tower block called Torre Windsor. This was a very substantial tower in Madrid, and if anybody had travelled to Madrid in the noughties, you may well have been familiar with it. During refurbishment works, a fire broke out in the upper stories of this particular building. The building was clad with ACM cladding, and the fire spread very rapidly from the upper floors down to the lower floors. Following an investigation, it was determined that the cladding which was found in this building was a principal cause of the exacerbation of the fire and one of the main reasons why the fire spread so rapidly from the top to the bottom. Thankfully, there were no injuries or deaths involving this particular tower because the building was empty during the refurbishment works. But unquestionably, the issue of cladding as a cause and an exacerbating factor in the spread of fire was started to be discussed in 2005 as a consequence of this catastrophic fire, which ultimately led to the demolition of the tower block in question. The other, perhaps a little closer to home to us, was in the UK, example of concerns about ACM cladding arose in the 2009 Lakenhall House disaster, where very sadly a number of people lost their lives. And a similar situation arose to one I just described in connection with Torre Windsor, where exterior cladding panels were ignited due to in an internal in one of the units fire commencing, and those cladding panels causing fire spread very rapidly throughout Lakenhall House. As I say, very sadly, people died in that particular disaster, and various recommendations were made to the Secretary of State by the coroner following the Lakenhall House fire, which included the reconsideration of building regulations and particular concerns regarding the fire safety of ACM cladding. Now, skip forward 8 years to June 2017, and the Grenfell Tower disaster really requires no introduction for me. It was obviously a horrific disaster, and a number of steps were taken by the government as a consequence of that. And I'll just turn to those steps very briefly in my next slide. In May 2018, the government started its examination, and the first point of that was the May 2018 report into the regulations and fire safety for building safety matters, which was put under the auspices of Dame Judith Hackett. That report was published in May 2018, and came up with what's been described as a damning assessment of the attitudes towards building safety found within the construction industry at the time. One of the most striking recommendations, I think, was the criticism of building safety requiring an absolute radical rethink, and concerns regarding the roles and responsibilities and also competence of those involved in the industry. As well as commencing this review chaired by Dame Judith Hackett, the government also at the same time started the Grenfell Tower inquiry, which of course has been the phase one report has now been issued, and phase two investigations I speak are currently underway. And I won't deal with that inquiry any further, but I will touch upon what happens after the initial report from May 2018, and that's in my next slide. And in December 2018, the government first started to set out put its cards on the table and set out how it would respond to concerns regarding building safety in light of the May 2018 report from Dame Judith Hackett. And those recommendations were found within a Building a Safer Future implementation plan published in December 2018. A number of regulatory requests and requirements were set out within that document. What struck me perhaps as being the most important general theme from the implementation plan was the observation that the construction industry needed to drive a culture of change and responsibility, and particularly to bear in mind the competence of those undertaking building work. Criticism had been levied by Dame Judith Hackett of a lack of a responsibility, and one of the implementation tasks for the government was to consider how the construction and fire safety sectors might work more holistically and focus beyond their own disciplines. At the same time, a joint regulators group was established to try and adopt some of these early recommendations. So into my next slide, further details provided in June 2019 with the publication of the government's consultation into building safety, which made a number of key proposals building on Dame Judith Hackett's earlier report. Those recommendations focused upon dealing with multi-occupied residential buildings that I mentioned a few moments ago, with the principal objective of creating accountability over the complete life cycle of buildings, and also making residents the center of a regulatory system, and at the same time introducing what was a very significant development of including mandatory occurrence reporting as a key regulatory requirement. The consultation also proposed establishing a competency steering group to ensure that proper levels of compliance and competence could be found throughout the industry. And the consultation also suggests that there ought to be robust sanctions of enforcement available with the creation of a new building safety regulator. In June 2019, that consultation was published. Turn to my next slide. By April 2020, following the completion of that consultation, the government started to set out more detail of what it was proposing a new building safety bill would look like. And that's found its way quite closely into the bill, which was published in July 2020, and which I'll discuss in a little bit more detail in a moment. Perhaps the most relevant part of this, again, is, as I mentioned earlier, was to drive a culture of change and responsibility within the construction industry, from design through to construction, and also for the management and refurbishment of construction works affecting those buildings which are within scope. The April 2020 proposals have been largely adopted in the draft Building Safety Bill, which was published a few months later in July 2020. Just turning then to the July 2020 bill, and to consider for a moment what the reform building safety system involves and what is required. And I'll turn to that now on my next slide. We're looking in the first instance at introducing a building safety regulator, and the details of that regulator can be found in sections 2 to section 8 of the Building Safety Bill. The regulator will have three broad functions, the principal ones here being the implementation of a new, more stringent regulatory regime for high-risk buildings, overseeing the safety and performance of the buildings which fall within the scope of the regulator's powers, and also encouraging competence by the establishment of various competency groups, and also reviewing the competence of building inspectors, which has become a central part of the building safety mechanisms. So that's where the building safety regulator's principal powers lie. The legislation rests upon a scheme of duty holders, and that's what I set out in the next slide. Those duty holder roles are familiar to anyone who has come across the CDM regulations, and you will find those duty holders being drawn largely from there. And the feel of the bill is very much one of closeness to the world of health and safety, and perhaps that's not a great surprise, given that Dame Judith Hackett was for a time chief executive of the Health and Safety Executive. The duty holders, as I say, form the bones of this new reformed building safety system, and they are set out in sections 8, section 16, and will be detailed further in secondary legislation. Each of the duty holders has its part to play in ensuring a compliance with a new safer building system. The duty holders, the principal duty holders are those of clients, principal designer, principal contractor, and by principal contractor, I think we're talking here about what would ordinarily be described as the main contractor. A designer, most likely to be any designer carrying out a trade or business which has modifies or has an impact upon the design of the building, and contractor, which is likely to encompass specialist contractors, particularly those who've got who touch and concerns, works touches and concerns sensitive parts of the building. And in this instance, you might start to think about cladding, for example. So those are the main duty holders, and the people who will be most interested in looking at the detail of the bill and the obligations which will be placed on them. Turning to my next slide. Each of the duty holders will have a set of generic obligations. And again, it's no great surprise that those obligations are focused upon ensuring the engineering and structural safety of buildings right through design and construction and through into occupancy. I mentioned earlier the onset of a mandatory occurrence reporting regime, and this is set out in section 78 of the bill, and is a significant development away from a previous culture which was criticized by Dame Judith Hackett as a culture of ignorance. A mandatory reporting regime now requires the duty holders I mentioned to report what is described as appropriate occurrences to the regulator. Those occurrences are defined as occurrences where the structural or the fire safety of a building is of such concern that it's likely to have an impact upon life, either through injury or through death. And any concern about the design or the construction of a building which raises those types of problems, the duty holder is now obliged to report to the building safety regulator. At the same time, the client is obliged to promote a culture of reporting, and the same obligations rest upon the other duty holders I mentioned a moment ago. The idea behind this is to encourage a transparency within the construction industry and a culture of compliance away from a culture of ignorance. Each of the stages in the construction process, it will now be managed through a series of gateway points, and I'll touch upon those gateway points in a little bit more detail in a moment. The principle behind this is that information ought to be transferred from one duty holder to another through the golden thread of building information. And that thread of golden information, again, was a key finding of Dame Judith Hackett and a key point of criticism for the construction industry, where attitudes towards siloing were identified by Dame Judith Hackett in her report. So just turn to my next slide. As I mentioned, the design and the construction of buildings is now will now be subject under the legislation to a series of gateways. And those gateways are at points which will be familiar to us, albeit the description of them perhaps is slightly different to the terminology currently in use. Gateway one will be the point before planning permission is granted, and the duties at this stage are duties to be imposed upon the client, so the developer. The gateway will require the client to be able to demonstrate that it has considered all of the necessary fire and structural risks that it can do at this point. It will be required to submit to the local planning authority planning information that demonstrates fire safety requirements, which are likely to impact at this point upon the design and construction of the building. And that information will take the form of a fire statement. So I think what the legislation has in mind here is considerations regarding things like access points, the availability of water, and how emergency services might be able to access the site during the construction phase of the development. So that's the sort of the early outset considerations which we find at Gateway 1 of the proposed regulatory system. And as each great gateway goes by, the obligations, it seems to me, become slightly more onerous. We'll see that the building safety regulator now plays a role at Gateway 1. And turning to my next slide, specialist fire safety input was likely to be required to enable the planning authority to take consideration of the fire safety plan. But I just want to move now to Gateway 2 and perhaps not to dwell too much further on that. Gateway 2 is a point at which construction has not yet commenced, but is about to, and that features in my next slide. The gateway, as I say, occurs prior to construction works. At this stage, the client is obliged to submit a deposit, a full set of plans demonstrating how fire and engineering risks are being managed through the construction phase. Those plans have to be submitted to the building safety regulator. And the gateway provides what's been described as a hard stop, where construction cannot commence unless the regulator is satisfied that the duty holder's design meets the requirements of the regulations and doesn't pose an unrealistic safety obligations or management obligations upon the parties. So there has to be a degree of realism, I think, in these plans. And I guess that means there'll have to be a degree of practicality as to how engineering and fire risks are being managed. But Gateway 2 clearly is a critical point in the process, and one can easily envisage if approval isn't obtained from the regulator at this point, that would have a serious impact upon the progress of works and the programme for the construction phase of the development. So a key point I would suggest in the design and construction of buildings. As I mentioned, all the duty holders have a role to play in Gateway 2. The principal designer, which is likely to be in most cases the architect, will be encouraged to adopt 3D BIM modelling as a way of demonstrating fire and structural safety compliance. And the principal contractor also has to be able to submit as part of its package a construction control plan. As I said, the regulator has at this stage the right to stop works from commencing and refuse its approval. Turn to my next slide and Gateway 3. Gateway 3 is what we might now consider to be perhaps practical completion and the building contract is the point where a final certification phase starts and building work has in the main finished. At this point, all the relevant documents, which will be prescribed in the secondary legislation, must be handed over to an accountable person, and I'll discuss the role of accountable person in a moment. The duty holders will also be required to submit to the building safety regulator relevant and documents and information on a final as-built basis. Turn to our next slide. The clients shall have to confirm to the building regulator that all the building regulations have been met, and the principal designer and principal contractor will be obliged to sign a final declaration of compliance. The relevance, I think, of Gateway 3 is that at this stage, the building is at the point of being very close to occupancy, and any hiccup in the process could easily, in my view, have a significant impact upon costs associated with overrun and potential delayed occupation of a building. And I suspect principal designers and principal contractors will be very keen to ensure that the regulator at this stage of the process is content and happy, and that there's no risk of a final declaration of compliance not being accepted by the regulator. So a key point in the whole construction phase, I think, will be the Gateway 3 process. Designers and contractors will be at considerable risk, as it seems to me at least, if approval from the regulator is not achieved at that point and before occupancy. So just turning to occupancy, what does the Building Safety Bill have to say? And the relevant parts of the bill are section 60 to section 77 of the draft bill. It's been said that the regulation of the occupancy phase of buildings is perhaps the most significant change. And I think I concur with that. The bill establishes a new duty holder during the occupation phase of buildings, and the duty holder is called the accountable person. There's some discussion at present as to who that accountable person would be. It's likely, it seems to me, that the accountable person will be most likely be the owner of the building, the developer, or perhaps somebody who has got the most significant control over the ownership structures of the buildings. I don't think at present, given some of the complex ownership arrangements that we find in the construction sector, I don't think the bill quite details in sufficient clarity the considerations as to how that accountable person role will be dealt with. But the common thinking at the moment is that the accountable person will likely be the developer. Now, the accountable person must ensure that during the occupancy of buildings, a building safety file is maintained, and that the building safety regulator remains content about the degree of assurance being provided by the accountable person. So turning to my next slide, the building safety regulator will issue a building assurance certificate if it is satisfied that the accountable person is complying and meeting its statutory obligations. The accountable person will be the point of reference and the body responsible for compliance during this phase. And the issue of the building assurance certificate is undoubtedly one of the most important parts of getting approval for occupancy. And that certificate will have to be displayed in a prominent position in buildings. So turn to my next slide. So how will safety be managed on a day-to-day basis? And will it just be down to the accountable person? Well, the answer to that is no. The accountable person will be required to appoint a competent building safety manager to carry out the day-to-day functions of ensuring the building is safely managed. The building safety manager can be an individual or an organization, but he's somebody who has the principal duty of supporting the accountable person in ensuring that fire and structural safety in the building is being managed properly. And I think we can have in mind here a role which requires a degree of day-to-day management, checking on buildings, checking on the management of systems, checking that fire safety requirements are being maintained. So things like the management of fire doors, the storage of refuse, building safety systems in buildings being properly operational. Those are the types of roles I think the building safety manager will find dealing with on a day-to-day basis. Turning to my next slide, which lists some of the proposed responsibilities for the building safety manager. My overall feeling is that this is a highly responsible position, and one that at the moment it's not clear what professionals have the necessary expertise to sit into the role of a building safety manager. On a practical basis, that in my opinion at least rests a high degree of uncertainty as to how the building safety manager role will be filled and who will be interested in taking it on, and whether insurance will be available for somebody taking on the building safety manager role. But either way, it's a critical part of the legislation, even if some of the practicalities are still to be determined. Just turning to my next slide, I touch briefly on what this means for residents of buildings which fall within the scope of the legislation. Well, as I mentioned at the outset, one of the key parts of the legislation is to put residents at the heart of the building safety system. Residents will have obligations placed upon them, and those obligations will include keeping in repair and working order items which are relevant to them and within their control, and to take reasonable steps to avoid damaging any relevant safety items. But at the same time, they also benefit from duties placed upon the accountable person, and that includes keeping residents up to date, and the completion of a residents' engagement strategy, which will set out how fire and engineering risks are being managed and how they're being delivered to residents. So is it clear to me at least that residents are now have a much closer role in the management of building safety. So turning to my next slide, what are the implications for duty holders? I only want to briefly mention here the issue of culture change. We've seen through the content of the draft bill a focus on safety reporting, improving competence and improving quality. And to focus just on the issue of improving quality, it's proposed that a code of quality management is acted upon, and that quality becomes a focus for those duty holders I mentioned a few moments ago. I think this is perhaps the single most important overarching principle behind the changes. And of course, legislation itself can drive a change of culture, but with some of the sanctions we'll come on to in a moment, I suspect there will be an increased focus upon competency, quality, and open reporting within organisations as a consequence of what the Building Safety Bill hopes to achieve. So, turn to my next slide. What does all this mean for insurers? It means a number of things, it seems to me, and I think the first point to bear in mind is that the ambition of the draft legislation is to produce a safer industry, creating less claims and fewer losses to insurers. And undoubtedly, if the draft legislation comes into force and acts as it's intended to, that will, it seems to me at least, be the outcome of the draft legislation. But at the same time, as we've seen already, there are new extensive duties being placed upon duty holders. Insurers will also want to consider what does mandatory reporting mean for notifications to policies, and also whether insurance will be available for regulatory fines, which the building safety regulator can levy. So just turn to my next slide and considering those points in a little more detail. We've mentioned already some of the new duties which are likely to be placed upon duty holders and construction professionals operating in this area. And there are various authorities that suggest that when regulatory obligations of this nature are breached, those breaches also amount to a breach of a professional's duty. In which case, it might be said that, for instance, where a designer fails to obtain an approval from the regulator, that could amount to a breach of its professional duty and therefore give rise to a cause of action against it. In that case, we might therefore see an increased number of claims being brought against professionals in this field. Interestingly, the creation of the building safety manager role, as I've mentioned, it's not clear what professional would be able to carry out and conduct that role, whether it falls within the expertise of any professional as it sits, and also whether there would be any appetite within the insurance industry to provide insurance to a person who has such a significant degree of responsibility for managing safety and engineering risks. So there are an extensive range of new duties placed upon professionals, which are likely to have an impact upon insurers. Turning to my next slide, what does the mandatory reporting requirements mean for notifications to policies? As you heard me say, the draft legislation requires mandatory reporting in circumstances where there are risks arising from structural and fire problems, which might give rise to a substantial risk to life. In those circumstances, would insurers require notification to them at the same time as the building safety regulator is being notified? It might be said that it would be prudent for insurers to require them to be notified, given the significance of the notification to the regulator and the likelihood of the civil claims arising against insurance policies as a consequence of circumstances which are notified to the regulator. Alternatively, would insurers prefer to stay away from that process and rest upon ordinary reporting notification requirements in policies? That, I think, needs to be considered in some more detail, but it does seem to me, at least, that there's a strong argument that underwriters would like to see notifications which are being produced to the building safety regulator, and that failure to do so might amount to a breach of policies conditions. So something that I think for underwriters to consider in more detail. So turn to my next slide. Mandatory occurrence reporting also arises during the occupation phase of buildings. And the same considerations arise, it seems to me. Will insurers wish to be informed on an ongoing basis of the numbers of reports made to the regulator? And will that have an impact upon the types of policies which are written and also upon the underwriting philosophy behind setting premiums? Again, and something which I think the insurance industry will no doubt have to grapple with in the coming months. Turning to my next slide, the building regulator has stringent enforcement powers where it finds that there are breaches of the legislation, and those enforcement powers, including the ability to set fines against bodies who are found to be in default, and also to bring and prosecute criminal offences against directors or managers, where it is shown that their actions have been a factor in a failure to comply with the obligations placed upon a particular duty holder. Those, I think, are very serious powers, and the building safety regulator is probably not likely to act lightly when it starts to take those steps. But it does give rise to considerations as to whether directors and officers insurers will be more closely brought into the world of building safety as a consequence. The building safety regulator also has the ability to levy fines, as I mentioned, and consideration, I suspect, will need to be given as to whether there is an insurable element to those civil fines and some consideration has been given to this in other areas within recent years, particularly in the field of data protection, and whether civil fines are ultimately insurable or not, or perhaps most importantly, whether the insurance market has any appetite for insuring fines in those circumstances. Turning to my next slide, I want to just mention very briefly here that the building safety regulator's powers don't just stop with fines and with criminal prosecutions. They also include the ability to prevent works continuing on site or to prevent works starting in the first place where there's a failure to comply or where there's a lack of appreciation and action upon notices given by the building safety regulator. So all these are quite draconian powers and have some influence and impact, I suspect, upon particularly directors and officers insurers, but perhaps other areas as well. Finally, on my next slide, the question again arises as to whether during the occupancy phase, the accountable person, where it is found to have not acted following notifications from the regulator, whether in those circumstances and there's serious risk to life, that becomes an issue for directors and officers, insurers. So those are some of the insurance considerations which the draft bill gives rise to. At the same time, and without yet featuring in the bill, current considerations arise regarding the issue of compensation for leaseholders who find themselves caught in buildings where there's known to be unsafe cladding materials. And in those circumstances, leaseholders are currently unable either to remortgage or unable to at present find the opportunity to sell their buildings because of concerns regarding fire safety. And at the same time, not able to finance remedial works. This is very much at the preliminary point of discussions, but there's some questions raised as to whether the Building Safety Bill will become a mechanism to enable those types of works to be carried out, perhaps under the auspices of the accountable person. The point as to who pays for those works remains, I think, a delicate one and one which is subject to a great deal of political controversy at the moment. At the same time, could the Building Safety Bill actually work as a mechanism for enabling remedial works to take place? Or is it either too far in the distance, or is there more pressing political considerations? Those are all points that I think will need to be thrashed out as the Building Safety Bill makes its way through Parliament in the coming months. But either way, as I mentioned at the outset, the draft legislation is likely to have a significant impact upon all the construction professionals who are involved in buildings which fall within its scope, and for all of those insurers who also have an interest in building safety. Thank you for listening to us this morning.